What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 102, Management of Hand and Wrist Fractures, with Dr. Matthew Keplinger of the Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. He is also an assistant professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston Medical School. Today we're talking about management of hand and wrist fractures. The first part is his lecture from the 13th Annual Sports Medicine Update presented by Memorial Hermann. The second part is our interview with him. Dr. Josh Yellen is helping out there on the interview. Jasmine Dozal is doing the tech or the back end of the interview, making sure the recordings are all set and running. So I want to thank them for their help there. My coworker Bill Hale and I are the ones running the sports medicine broadcast and kind of in and out there. So we, if you'll notice during the interview, there's a storm going on, so we actually lost power. But don't worry about that. It gets a little noisy because people start getting into the hallway rather than into the lecture hall. But again, we are looking for people to do some reviews of the sports medicine broadcast. So, you know, make sure you mention the fact that we were determined and we fought through the power outages during live recordings on your in review and say just how dedicated and determined we are. So again, go to iTunes, review it, rate it, and I'll do my best to read those here on the podcast. Starting September 3rd, the webinars will begin, and you should be able to do those live. Once you join the email list, I'll send out the email saying, hey, this one's up, you can sign up. So again, join the email list. It's on the website, and rate it on iTunes. So for Jeremy, the Sports Medicine Broadcast team, we're looking to bring you another great season of interviews with sports medicine professionals. And if there's something specific you would like to hear about, then let us know. You can contact us, contact me on sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. There's all the ways you can contact me, Twitter, PHS Sports Med, email, Facebook, Google+. Again, all that's on there. So again, this is Dr. Matthew Keplinger with management of hand and wrist fractures. Thanks for listening.
Is this thing too loud or not okay? Yeah, okay, good. Like Bob said, I kind of come up met these things from a similar approach to you all, and just a way of thinking of kind of outside of the box and approaching things. That's the best way of getting the people, the students or your athletes back to a competitive level safely. Not putting them in harm's way, certainly not putting yourself in harm's way from a legal standpoint. And today we're going to sort of approach some of these more obscure problems today as from a case-based circumstance. So I'll try to provide you all with some information and kind of have some audience interaction today. So it's not just a yammering talking head that's going to control this thing after your midday lunch here. These can be pretty confounding. For the most part, for a lot of things, the wrist in and of itself is a pretty complicated joint, especially with all the neurovascular structures and some of the bony and neurovascular and muscle skeletal anatomy surrounding it. So, we try to just try to break some of these things down from an algorithmic point of view and approach things from that standpoint. The idea, obviously, here is to ease your frustration with some of these specific types of injuries. I can talk about trying to approach it from a case standpoint, discuss some of the management of these. I'm really trying to gain appreciation for a team approach. You know, sometimes y'all think this is the burden is on you. And I would encourage y'all, I mean, y'all are allied health professionals. You got to sit for a national certification, you got an anything CME. This is not something that you pick up at a weekend seminar and you brush up on it and you're good to go. This is something where, and that's really what kind of got me into trying to go to medical school was not with a big bucks in a few hours, but Bob said it was, I thought I knew this better than a lot of my team physicians did. In some instances I did, some instances I didn't. But that's what kind of drove me to do something with it more. So, you know, see these kids every single day, you know what they're like, you know if they're kind of malingering, you know if they're gaining some attention from it. You guys have a better insight from the standpoint of seeing them every day in and day out, knowing them personally than I ever will. I'll see them for 20 minutes and I'll be under the net. So envious in some instances of sort of the relationship. There's always those people that you wish you could go away. I don't have anything to disclose. I've got pictures of my kids where I used to have money. So, first case, guy hits a crummy golf shot. I know in this room what that's like. So, striking the ball or not. And they're kind of basic complaint of palmar ulnar wrist pain. Think of the mechanism of injury, what kind of a differential group would you be considering here? So, palmar and ulnar sided wrist pain, what are some of the things, top things that you consider as far as those performances? So, hammy, you know, nerves, blood vessels, but even if this is sort of an acute injury, even versus like a chronic injury, this is an industrial accident. And you maybe see some industrial type settings for people, you know, usually the older guys that don't know any better or more wisdom, but using the pain standards and stuff like that. That can provide some kind of a vascular damage. Imaging from that standpoint, I mean, that's obviously not something that y'all consider, but from our standpoint, so imaging standpoint, maybe consider plain film. If I always start with that, I always think it's the easiest thing, it's the cheapest thing, it's easy to get. You don't need to have real good radiography technique, although some of the specific risk problems, it certainly helps. I often don't get an MRI unless I'm ruling out something that's just so off the reservation that I don't know what I'm looking for or what I'm planning for surgery. From a management standpoint, acute injury, simple things, rest ice, compression, elevation, activity modification. Then somebody brought something else up here, but there's complaints of numbness or tingling. That's something else to consider. Sometimes that's a recombinant problem. In addition to the pain, again, numbness and tingling for the fingers. So we brought up some of these simple hand-aid fractures, which is fairly common, and or cruciform fractures. So cruciform is pretty easy to feel, kind of at the look at your hand, kind of at the bottom position, pretty prominent. It's almost like a sesamoid bone basically articulates with the triquetrum, but it actually develops within the FCU. And then just on the opposite side of that there's the hamate running close, really basically creates the borders of the Peano's canal. That's where your ulnar nerve and artery run. Mechanism of injury is pretty common. Get some, it's not just in a ball, obviously, but you can get a lot of rapid sports. Some of the baseball players have been in it, I've seen it several baseball players here recently. Often just from a ball in an outstretched hand, but usually some kind of an implement sport, rapid baseball ball. Basically, just kind of get an obscure load directly right, depending on where that implement is resting, right on the hand. Sometimes you get a check swing where, depending on how they're holding the bat, right where that bat is basically ending, right there, right over the hammock. And then you can basically get some kind of a tension through some of the muscular attachments. Most of the time it's the transverse carpal ligament that helps to make the roof of the carpal tunnel that's kind of attached to the hammock. And then the x-ray, it doesn't always often show specifically for a hook and handmade or form fractures. You're going to need a specialized x-ray. This is a carpal tunnel view. So basically, they're just going to take a shot right down through the palm of the hand. And it really shows you really very nicely. This is obviously the thumb side, small finger side. So they've got ulnar sided wrist pain. The palmer would be easily able to see that hook of the handmade right there. And then think of this as the carpal tunnel, and then all of your nine flexor tendons and the median nerve kind of runs through there. They may or may not have median nerve symptoms. More often than not, they have some kind of an ulnar nerve symptom because of inflammation, perhaps maybe some of the discrete fracture. And then you consider the piece of arm, and then articulate the triquetral. I've seen a handful of cases where you have some piece of triquetral arthritis. some pretty unlikely sources, specifically a guy who played violin for a living. That's something that's kind of, like I said, that's kind of the zebra when you hear about it outside of the room and not the forces. Other things to consider, CT scans, sometimes that will give you a little more insight and get to the radiography or if it's just scratching the head. MRI of a plus minus thing, it may show you some hematoma, may show you some of the other neurovascular structures a little bit easier. And like we talked about, you know, as far as the piece of one is this one, see on standard radiographs, you might need to get it over. This shows a little bit more, wearing of the underside of the piece of one. So obviously, initially, just try to immobilize and try to protect them. From my standpoint, this isn't a real crucial bone. We can never fix it. If it becomes problematic enough, take it out. But that's certainly, that's invasive. That's keeping them out probably for about 2 weeks. That's not always good. Then, of course, certainly, there's a lot of stuff in there. You think it's just real easy to go when you get it. So, I go through the skin, the fat, the fascia, and then there's muscle. There's a lot more depth to it than you think, even though you can feel it right there. Short on gas, typically it's pretty good for most of these things. And if it becomes too symptomatic, it's not going away, you got to get back to play. That's the stabilizer of this. That's kind of what it would work. Obviously, big things, inflammatories. I've even seen some guys, baseball players, that have specific pads built into their glove or onto their bat. Obviously, with alterations and stuff like that. So, like we already kind of highlighted, what else is in there? Neurovascular and fondling. That's the biggest thing. So, just because there's pain, start to think there's a kind of an alteration in the neurovascular function as well. May see a tingling versus plus minus, there's any kind of pretty good hand weakness, the ability to pass off the fingers. If it's chronic enough, you might even see some atrophy in the first school, so that's where that you can really see it. That's that beast into that muscle. So here's another guy, tennis player, and he had four wrist pain, or the ulnar side, of course, and he's striking with a bat hand. So dorsal, ulnar side of wrist pain, so ball work on the other hand. So what are some of the things? This is kind of the ulnar side of wrist pain is kind of the black box of the wrist. It could be multiple things. So now we're localizing more dorsal work. So the DRUJ is just the radial ulnar joint, that's a big one. What else? Other things, PFCEC, ECU tendonitis or ECU subluxation, something really weird, some type of a styloid, displaced styloid fragment, and now it's a chronic injury to the non-immune. Weird things like that, other sources of tendonitis that are there as well. So obviously any kind of under associated differential diagnosis we kind of look at. Rheumatoid cuticle instability too is also something else that gets consideration too. Don't often see that, at least not makes sense. It's mostly like a scapulo-lunate instability. Rheumatoid cuticle instability is very rare. Usually a high atrogenic, so if some dummy did something, it should be done. We'll address the breather on the scope or something along those lines and create that instability. So if something like this comes about, that's where you would find some type of a BC, so a bulbar intercalated segment instability where that you're looking on the lateral of the x-ray, it dumps itself forward as opposed to a BC where it dumps itself back. The distal radial ulnar joint instability or the injury. And oftentimes, especially depending on the age of the patient, we may find some elements of osteoarthritis or some the very brief generation there as well. Talk about the almost dilated on you. Plenty of people that, you know, got the fallen out stretch and seem pretty benign, nothing else is fractured. It's a little bit sort of weird. People walking around, and if you would probably miss it in this audience now, people almost dilated on you. Some of the literature is kind of panned out. Really don't fix those. Not really something that demonstrates a whole lot of TFCC stability if you fix it. And something else, other things to consider, the ECU tendinopathy. So this is something that can be pretty confounding for a lot of people. You can have such degrees of subluxation, tendinitis, or the rupture of the tendon itself. And some of these things, as far as, you know, varying degrees, they're going to require other circumstances or other things for the rest of it. So from the subluxation or the instability standpoint, you think of there are really kind of two layers that are holding that ECU in place. That ECU runs in its own tendon tunnel through the extensor retina. So that would have to be maintained or breached. Plus the subsheet, so the present injury care ECU subsheet, is actually get that thing to pop in and out and out. And it's not maintained within that osseous groove on the back of the bone. Some type of forceful supination with flexion and ulnar deviation, some of the common mechanisms within your sports. This is something else that I've seen. Forceful twisting of the drill. Again, some of the industrial accidents, when you're running your drill and it just decides to crap out on you, it pushes you one way or the other. So this is kind of a schematic when you think of the extensor retinaculum, six different tunnels within the extensor retinaculum. This runs in its own tunnel, the sixth tunnel. And then the retinaculum, and then the ECU subsheet, and then it kind of runs in this fibro-osseous group right on the back of the ulna. PRUK is right there. All of this becomes critical and important for us thinking of what could this thing be if there are stuff in this. So thinking as far as what's comfortable, like brace this, how do I protect this, how do I shut this thing down? If the wrist is pronated, you've got a truer force for that ECU tendon versus if it's supinated. And patients will typically want to hold their wrist in this type of a position. So the way you brace it is pronate them. Sometimes it's easy to say, it's hard to do. Sometimes referring to a therapist to make a clinical plastic brace or something along those lines might be a good idea. If they're a bad player, they go to CAT scans for 4 weeks just to shut this thing down. Pronated, ulna deviated, and slightly flexed a little bit, or pseudo neutral risk of standing this and shut down. So as far as the instability goes, there are different variations of instability where you can sort of see that this thing sometimes doesn't quite escape the subsheet, sometimes it does. Sometimes it can get caught, actually dislocated outside of the subsheet within. Just underneath the retinaculum. And then as these things, you know, between the supination and pronation, this thing will slide in and out. And then sometimes this thing, as it completely dislocates, it's going to be hard to get it to go back in stable fashion. The stability basically that we'll complain of usually some kind of snapping or clicking, painful, and then might have some provocative testing. You can try to actively supinate or passive supination that will be able to visualize, or they'll tell you that thing is popping out. You can sometimes see it in skinnier athletes. Active supination, flexion, and ulnar deviation, you can set it off. For me, I like this test, this eucinity test, where it really kind of brings that ECU up close to the surface. Basically, all your resistance is abduction of the thumb, the middle finger, and supinated position. This may create a provocative, just from a painful standpoint, which kind of shows you maybe it's just a tendonitis, or if this thing wants to slide up, you'll actually be able to see it and visualize it. Sometimes getting your thumb gently over it, you can feel this like sliding out. You try to really push your thumb onto it, you might actually be just holding it. You just kind of got to be careful. Dynamic ultrasound, I've been using this a little more often. It's cheap, it's easy. You can get it that day, but you got to have a good sonographer. I use it for post-trauma, flexor tendon evaluation of my repairs with the dam or not, or if the patient fit in the following instructions. But I usually show these pretty good visualization, fairly nice. But here's a good demonstration here where you see the tendon is reduced. And you can see here that the tendon is basically out where it doesn't belong. It needs to be in the groove. And then this is in supination with pronation. You can see the difference where this subsheath is basically not holding anything. Some different variations here where you start to see this MRI becomes helpful from a planning standpoint. So we've got some demonstration clinically, this thing is coming out. We've got some demonstration that I always would try immobilization first and foremost just because they got a snap in their subluxation tendon. He doesn't manifest itself into a cervical repair right out of the box. We've got some demonstrable recreation of the instability. We've got ultrasound, or if there's some other MRI changes that it might manifest itself into indication for surgery, that's something else to consider. So here, this is a healthy thing. You got a good looking retinaculum, a good looking subsheet, and the tendon looks good. Versus here, not so healthy. The DRUJ looks good. This is the dorsum. This is the polar aspect. Black is the tendon. Black is the tendon. There's a lot of inflammation surrounding that tendon. You might even see some degenerative changes within the tendon itself. Tendinosis as opposed to tendonitis. And then you start to see a lack of clarity of the subsheath. And then you also see some edema in the bone itself. This is a chronic problem. This is something that they require reconstruction of that subsheath. And then the thing is basically completely out. Subsheath is probably preventing it from getting back in. The thing is torn and it's the fret core has been released. Now this thing isn't allowing that to get back in. So management, I always try splinting first. This is a little too much, but I think you get a good therapist. Maybe many of you are really good at bracing. It's not just the wrist pop-ups, but it's going to have to be something that's going to maintain that pronated position, keep it straight, faster that tendon as possible. I've seen some of these things. These things are pretty cool, where basically the chronic subluxation tendon is just a simple little rubberized brace that fit right over the tendon. And almost so it's like it's an external mobilizer, so kind of nice. Activity modification, you know, which is good. Corticosteroid injection, plus minus thing. Some people respond very well from it. Some people, if there's a tendinosis or degenerative aspect of the tendon, then we have some other problems. Obviously, consideration for surgical intervention or everything else they are. Surgery, in my opinion, ought to be a last resort. Unless these guys are making a lot of money and they gotta get back to it. Plus, another common problem here, so tackle type injury, ankle dysfunctional ring finger from some type of a grasp of a tackle. And this is how they present. This is the ring finger. So, normal resting cascade of the hand is simply in a flexed position, right? It's not out straight. So what are some of the things that you see that just don't look quite right? What are some of the things you think about?
Okay.
What's that? Yeah, so a flexor tendon avulsion injury, but the FPS is intact, but FPP lacks function. And it's sometimes a little bit easier way having a make of this, and that thing is described straight for the VIP script. Jersey finger is a pretty common injury. It's kind of a pain in the butt to deal with. They'll have tears in the palpation. Sometimes pain in the palm which would imply something a little bit more significant. You've got this can pull all the way off versus a PIP is a polar aspect. And this may involve more of a fracture phenomenon. This is a little bit of a busy slide. This is kind of breaks up the FVP avulsion injury into four different types. A lot of it's going to depend on where the level of the injury is, how far it's retracted, if there's a fracture involved, and then all of those things kind of require a loop to help with the tendon. I think in terms of fractures, tendon is probably right there, not really displaced. Or you have a fracture in the clump of other bone or other tissue there on the flank. That's going to be a problem. If it's closer here, you can get to it a little bit later. If it's farther away, you're going to have to do something. Doesn't the same way to help. Thinking in terms of what the anatomy looks like, remember the FDP, which is the frontal fundus, goes all the way down to the distal tendon. FDS splits and parts itself vertically, attaches itself right on the middle valley. There's a variety of vincula. The vincula are what carry the blood supply into the tendon and nourish the tendon. So this is why if you've got an FDP, go all the way back to here, you've really got some of the short and long vincula that are basically compromised. The longer you wait, the less likely that tendon is going to be really damaged. It's not going to heal just because that may reach that blood supply. So workup, I talked about imaging already. X-ray is pretty simple. You look for a fracture with a predicted location. Sometimes it can show you some imaging. Ultrasound and MRI can also be beneficial. MRI is expensive. Sometimes it can be misleading because of the inflammation, but ultrasound is really beneficial for me. Again, need a good ultrasound. They're easy, cheap, usually you can get on safely. Again, for me, this is a more impressive injury. The sooner I can get to it, the better. It's more of a, this is like a tendon rupture or somebody that's cut the tendon. They're going to have a long process of therapy rehab. Right, the gliding of the tendons prevents adhesion formation. That's something else to consider. These people are going to be out for a little bit longer. I'd say 5 to 6 weeks, just from the standpoint of the window of time after you repair the tendon into the bone is going to be very weak, probably about 4 to 6 weeks. Protect that, and then get a range of motion and prevention of tendon adhesions. Pretty arduous process. The patient's got to be on board for that, though, after that. Flexor tendon rehab is on the team. Team approach, good therapy. Good interaction and communication, that's the biggest thing with everybody. And I always kind of involved in any other trainer that I've definitely worked with. I've got no office hours, so anytime that you've got a question, you've got a concern, give us a call. It's easier to deal with it and say, oh, no, Saturday, sorry. The other thing to consider is that the FDR prosthesis. Obviously, you're losing some of that last little bit of function, but if you put it into a functional position, use it more predictable, then sometimes with the tendon bone interfaces, it's healing bone to bone. Everybody's a little bit different, depends on the kid, on how to fix it. If it's an older patient with industrial accident, I'm going to take consideration to this is not to be concerned, not to be confused with other developments of other tendon injuries now at fingers, where there's some type of a rupture of the extensor, common extensor tendon. This is where that last little distal phalanx is going to drop down and present itself better. Sometimes you have a fracture, sometimes you don't. I absolutely hate these injuries. I think they're overtreated, they're a pain in the butt, hard to treat because patients don't keep the splints on. It's easy to say, it's hard to do. If you feel like they're in jail. I think it's less of a concern, like can't pick my hand in my pocket, well, we don't do that. But it's more of a concern if you're keyboarding, especially in this day and age where you're keyboarding and you have a stable blood pressure keyboard. Now, finger tendon injury cure versus a common bone injury. Sometimes you fix it, it's a lot of blood supplementation. Again, splinting, we say it's hard to do. about 6 weeks of a tendon injury, 6 weeks full time student. Versus the foot tear deformity, which is called a central slip injury. It's going to be up here, so the central slip as it inserts right on the middle phalanx. This is where you get the lateral band subluxed down, flexors instead of extensors. This is Ellison's test. If you resist your extension of the PIC joint, you should have a floppy phalanx. You see that if the central slip is ruptured, the lateral band is still going to be pulling on the distal phalanx, keeping that DID straight. Usually, splinting is the biggest injury. I let that hand injury be over my fault. But your ring splints are nice. So, in general, try to work around mobility, do the best you can. Splinting is a different feature. Both of these things are handled on a overview, generalized basis, anti-inflammatory. Try not to compromise your competitive level. By being creative, you're used to making lasers out of popsicle sticks with a dirt and obviously use a team to throw a shot.
Hi everybody, welcome back to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I'm Dr. Josh Ellen with the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program. You can catch us at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. Follow us on Twitter, U of H MAT. You can catch the Sports Medicine Broadcast at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com or follow them on Twitter at the Sports Medicine Broadcast. Isn't that right? The Twitter handle? What's the Twitter handle? Hashtag PHS.
No.
There is no hashtag.
It's hashtag VSMB.
Yeah, the hashtag VSMB and then at
PHS Sports
Medicine. PHS Sports Medicine. To my right, I have Dr. Matthew Keplinger.
Sure.
And Dr. Keplinger, thank you very much. Tell us a little bit about your background. So you are an orthopedic surgeon. And as we were having a conversation before, you're a DO, but you have a really interesting background on how you got to where you are. So let's start way back from the beginning. You are actually an athletic trainer. All right, so talk to us. Where'd you go to undergrad? Where'd you go to grad school? What were you doing? How'd you get to where? Get me right to when you start DO school.
Yeah, I guess it started, I was at Ohio State for undergraduate, and then I did an internship program.
And what
there.
What year was this?
That was 94.
So, the accredited program really doesn't happen until about 2000, 2004.
That's right.
So you're going through the internship.
Yeah, we were slugging it out, and I loved it, though. It was one of those things that it kind of found me. I was interested in physical therapy, and it kind of found me. And so did that route, went ahead and did a graduate assistantship at LSU.
Okay.
Worked there for 2 years.
And we were talking about that you and I have some common roads, that we were just talking with Webb Miranda before this, and he's an athletic trainer with United Airlines.
United here in Houston.
And Webb said that he came out about the same time, and I said, I lived in Baton Rouge for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And turns out that you and I also have some commonalities in people we know.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've always said that's unique about athletic training is that you got the Kevin Bacon 6 or 7 degrees of separation, mm-hmm. right?
That's right.
But in athletic training, so here's another example. You and I don't know each other until about 10 minutes ago.
That's right.
But, boy, we know some people that know us.
Right.
So I can get to you through a few different ways.
Absolutely.
Okay, yep. So you do your graduate assistant at LSU. What year did you graduate?
96.
Okay, and then after that, what happened?
I did a year with the Cincinnati Bengals. I'm still wanting to do that, but then I had this opportunity at Marietta College. I taught in the sports medicine department there for 3 years. It was a great experience, and somehow then I got a wild hair and wanted to give medical school a shot. And honestly, I'll tell people this all the time. I went to medical school because I couldn't get into PT school. It was one of those things you kept trying to do, it just wasn't going to work. And we all have a path laid out for us, whether we like it or not.
Right.
So that's kind of the course that I took. I was very, very fortunate, very blessed to be with some really great people at Marietta College up in Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And and was able to kind of work through some of my prerequisites. And it's one of those things, I'm going to give this a one-shot deal. It was a great job. I still miss it to this day.
Uh-huh.
But this was a path that was laid out before me. I went to medical school at Ohio University. And it's an osteopathic school.
Right. And they have a great post-professional master's degree with a guy by the name of Chad Starkey.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my former students, Jeremy Uze, came out of that master's degree. And you may have had some interaction. I don't know whether or not. But now Jeremy is finishing up the Doctor of Athletic Training program at Idaho, I think it is.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Good. Small world. Okay, yeah. So you go DO school at Ohio University.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And let's stop there. So let's kind of backtrack a little bit. So undergraduate Ohio State, graduate school at LSU, year with the Cincinnati Bengals. Then you go to Marietta College in Ohio.
Right.
And you start taking some prereqs. So you're faculty there and you're taking some prereqs. And you said, hey, listen, I want to give med school a shot. What led you to the osteopathic path versus the allopathic? So a lot of people, you know, like Jasmine, for instance, you know the difference between an MD and a DO? Right. So a lot of people in the United States, they see the MD and there's name brand recognition, right? A lot of what we're seeing in athletic training, AT versus PT.
Right.
And so the DO is really an osteopathic, it's an osteopathic physician. The MD and the DO have all the rights of one another, right? You can practice a DO as a physician just like an MD. But there's two different philosophies, right? Allopathic versus osteopathic.
Right.
So there's some people that are listening like Jasmine who are juniors at Texas A&M, they're thinking about going to graduate school in athletic training. So please tell us the difference a little bit.
Sure. Osteopathic medicine was actually founded by an MD, Andrew Taylor Still, back in the late 1800s, so 1880 their range. He was a surgeon in the Civil War, and really was at some point in time, he was a very religious man. But at some point in time, he got basically fed up with modern medicine, saw that as poison. Medicine is one of these things where there's a lot of obscurities. Or why do you do what you do? Well, it's because that we don't know. We really don't know. And he built his brand of medicine on the basis of it was a belief in a great creator that would provide us with the ability to heal ourselves. So he built all of this around the musculoskeletal system, and his saying is, or was, the rule of the artery is supreme.
Mm-hmm.
So if he could manipulate soft tissue, myofascial releases, musculoskeletal alignment procedures, that would provide the avenue for the body to heal itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, his initial brand of medicine was devoid of any medications whatsoever. Of
course, what we think now is chiropractic.
Right.
Right.
Now, they weren't, and that's an interesting point you bring up, they were, the founder of chiropractic medicine was actually a grocer, wasn't a physician, and they were contemporaries, but they were not colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, again, it depends on how you look at the different points of view from the history. Osteopathic medicine is still built on the basis of treating the holistic person.
Okay, so let's go back a couple sentences. The founder of chiropractic medicine, what we'll say, was a grocer.
Grocer.
Like owned a grocery store.
Grocery store.
Okay, I understand. Okay, let's continue on.
Sure.
I just want to make sure I got that
That's
right.
Okay. That's okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, the osteopathic brand is basically built on trying to treat the entire person and looking at things not just from a shoulder pain problem, but what's causing that shoulder pain. Is it, weak or underdeveloped or a deconditioning of the scapular stabilizers, or is it, as opposed to just treating shoulder pain, you're treating the cause of the pain, or maybe you're treating some of the other components that are affiliated with that, or the diabetes that somebody may be manifesting. How does that manifest itself, not just from a musculoskeletal standpoint, but from a holistic and entire systemic standpoint?
Sounds like everything you're bringing up is right in line with athletic training.
Right, exactly.
So I can totally see how you as an athletic trainer really move into the osteopathic.
That was the appeal for me because when I first started, it was, working with team physicians, I got frustrated because I knew this stuff. I'm seeing these athletes day in and day out.
Right.
I know what's working. I know what's not working. And then I get frustrated when, basically you don't have any say as the athletic trainer, which is wrong. I think, we're allied health professionals. We have to take state and national board certification exams. We have to be licensed by the state. you know, you don't have the capacity or the capability to, you know, to prescribe medications, but sometimes that's a good thing.
Right.
Because it forces you to use some other things. Use your brain, use some muscle physiology techniques, use some physical medicine
techniques. Yeah, you can't just throw a medicine at it, right?
I hated about, you know, a lot of the, I had some great team physicians, don't get me wrong, that were helping me along the way, but I hated that. Well, let's get a shot. Well, you need surgery. Right? No. I mean, now that guy is out. If he's got surgery, in some instances, it's indicated. There's no going back. But, you know, now they're out. They're done.
Right.
And they may never be the same.
Right.
So that's what I got frustrated with. That's what forced me to try to find a better way to give myself that added edge. And,
right.
Of course, sports medicine was my ideal approach initially.
Right.
But as, you know, a good medical, basic medical education program will provide you, it's a variety of settings. So
right.
I went into it with an open mind. Every rotation I was on was something new. It was terrific. But something kept pulling me back in towards the physical medicine aspects of things. Orthopedic surgery was somewhat appealing. I liked a lot of the people that I was around.
Mm-hmm.
We're cut from the same piece of cloth. Generally, they're very hard workers. They
right.
just get it done.
Right.
And that's another commonality with athletic trainers. They just get it done.
Right.
They don't say, well, that's not my job, because an athletic trainer has so many hats to wear.
Right.
It's, you know, in some instances, you're the laundry guy, you're the equipment guy.
Yeah, you
you're
know, I've
parent,
talked to, yeah,
you're the
I,
shoulder
I,
to cry.
I talked to some athletic trainers who are, you know, athletic trainers at the high school, and, you know, at the high school, man, you're it.
Mm-hmm.
And we just talked with Webb earlier, and when he was telling me that his experience up at Temple in Philadelphia,
yeah.
he was the only athletic trainer for, you know, what seemed to be a million, you know, patients, and he's running around covering a half a million sports, and
right.
he's trying to, you know, keep everything in order. And,
yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that, you know, over the last decade or so, athletic training has really really gotten some stabilization there, and is really,
which is good,
yeah, moving up.
And
but it was
a
lot
a
different when
coming.
you and I were coming through.
Yeah.
It was a lot different.
Right.
It sounds like you and I went on to some, I'll call it postgraduate work, whether you went on to medical school and I went on and got my doctorate, and we really went on for the same reasons that, hey, you know, I'm a little frustrated with where we are now,
yeah.
and I think that the only way I can change it is go on and get this education and then come back,
right?
You know, pull my sleeves up and get dirty and let's go.
Right, absolutely.
Okay, so you come out of osteopathic medical school. Now, we've talked to a couple other physicians, and again, we have some people that are listening to this radio show. Maybe it's some of my graduate students that are just getting into athletic training. And they're trying to think, okay, I've heard a number of different physicians. We had here sitting exactly where you are. We've had Walt Lowe. We've had Jim Muntz. We had Rahul Bajani. We had some other people that they're all in that kind of sports medicine umbrella, but they've taken these different routes. And so when you look at osteopathic medicine, a lot of the osteopaths go on, and they go on to family medicine. They go on to, right?
Right.
Rare that the osteopath, and the reason why I have so much admiration, one of my big mentors, Dr. Jerry Bornstein. Dr. Bornstein was an osteopath and orthopedic surgeon and old school, and back in the 60s, California passed a law where you could change your DO to an MD for $50. That's right.
Yeah.
So he changed from a DO to an MD, but he still uses all of his DO stuff.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what's the difference in training between DO and MD, and tell us a little bit more about why you chose orthopedic surgery to stay in sports medicine rather than, because it seemed like a DO in physical medicine rehabilitation might be a good fit,
mm-hmm.
or a DO in internal medicine or family medicine might be a good fit.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so the initial training, I think, in the difference between DO and MD just in medical school is there's not a lot of difference. We actually have a little bit more anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
I think the anatomy, at least from my experience with a couple of medical schools that I help teach at here in Houston, they cram it all into about a 3-month window.
Yeah.
We're doing anatomy for a year,
right.
the first year, and it's just part of the curriculum. And then there's some neuroanatomy that's for about 3 months in your second year. But and then in incorporation with that added emphasis of the human anatomy, you're also incorporating, it's called osteopathic manipulative medicine, mm. OMM, or it's got a, depending on...
OMT or something, yeah.
OMT, exactly.
Or MOMT.
Right. Right, so whatever alphabet soup acronym
right.
you want to use.
Right.
But it's basically the same basic skills where you're learning how to evaluate a patient from a musculoskeletal standpoint, correlate a lot of these musculoskeletal findings perhaps with some, not just physical complaints and ailments, but also some systemic problems.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really taking a different point of view and looking at the body, not just from what does the lab work show, what does the MRI show, what does the x-ray show, what are they acting and looking like, but from a standpoint of how is their body radiating or making this noise that you've got to pick up and
right.
listen to.
Right. So, and I tell this story all the time when I teach the manual manipulative therapy in my rehab class, is that I walk into an athletic training one day, and you know, a quarterback is mid-thoracics, it's really, you know, it's just on fire. He's having trouble breathing, he's got that sharp stabbing, and they take him for an x-ray, they can't find anything. Take him for an MRI, they can't find anything.
Right.
And I do my evaluation, I said, he's got a rib head out.
Right.
What do you mean? What is that?
Right.
And I manipulate it back in, and you know, that initial manipulation, the kid loses his breath, but then all of a sudden the pain's gone.
You reset move. Everything.
Right.
That's exactly
right.
Right.
Okay, so it sounds like right off the bat, and I'm glad you brought up the thing about anatomy, because in order to get into the Master of Athletic Training program at the University of Houston, you already need a year of A&P, so A&P 1, A&P 2. You need biomechanics and exercise physiology and what we call anatomical kinesiology, you know, like functional and motor learning. And then your first class that you take is an anatomy class with me that's a hybrid of functional anatomy and gross anatomy. We're working on cadavers.
Great.
So I'm going to extend the offer that over this summer, maybe we can put a scalp on your hand and you come on
yeah,
over.
We love that.
And
I taught cadaver anatomy at Marietta College.
Oh,
it
yeah.
It was
it's another commonality.
Yeah.
I taught cadaver anatomy too.
Yeah.
Okay, so you go through osteopathic school and you come out in what year? You graduate when?
2003.
Okay, and so you graduate in 2003 and then you go on for a residency where?
At Toledo, in Toledo, Ohio. Which was we had an affiliated hospital with Ohio University.
And is it an osteopathic hospital?
It is a general. We had MDs and DOs working side by side.
And when you're out of curiosity, because I look at the DOs similar to how I look at the ATs,
mm-hmm.
right? Where there's some brand recognition, right?
Right.
What's the in the ATPT world? There's always some. Turf battles. Is there some turf battles with the DO and the MDs or not?
It's less and less, and I think a lot of it's old thinking. There's, you know, and it depends, it's regionality too. The Midwest, where there's a huge number of DO schools, people, you know, it kind of goes hand in hand. They know there's no difference. General public knows there's no difference. And down here in Houston, I think I'm, as an orthopedic surgeon, I'm one of maybe three or four
in the state,
just in Houston.
In Houston,
so there's a greater preponderance of them up north
mm-hmm.
near University of North Texas, where
mm-hmm.
the DO school is.
Right.
The DO schools they pride themselves on primary care.
Right.
So family practice is brought up, internal medicine, obstetrics, gynecology. I would also say orthopedic surgery is a primary care.
Right.
So you know people are coming in to see you. You're the first guy they're seeing. They've got a broken this or that, or a dislocated this or that. I mean, you know, you could go to your family practice physician. They should be able to know how to handle it. But the way medical education and training is going, it's definitely on their hands.
Yeah,
like
hey, this is a referral.
Over that guy, exactly.
Yeah, this is a
so
referral.
I'd make that argument. And as they also pride themselves on servicing the medically underserved,
yeah.
So they'll be find more DOs in a rural setting.
Right.
That's why all of your initial schools were kind of although Philadelphia's centric, but Athens, Ohio, where
right.
I went to school, it's in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
You know, it's affiliated with a college town, Ohio University, big university, but you got to know you got to be meaning to get there. It's not
right.
something you just stumble.
Right.
It's,
yeah.
It's
I mean, it's
away
like
the
when I took my electives in graduate school, I was at Long Beach State, and I took 6 hours of electives at the College of Osteopathic Medicine in Pomona. And,
right.
You know, to get to Pomona was a drive, and
that's
like you
right.
said, I had you had to
right.
you had a reason to be there.
Right.
You weren't
but
just passing
servicing
through.
That community.
Right. Right.
And that's what they want. They want to basically outfit you to be able to be that front line. Not to be reliant on a multitude of other specialists,
okay.
A multitude of virtual anything you need from a diagnostic standpoint. We need the electronic doctor that's $1 million, and we need it here.
But right.
No, you're the person.
Yeah.
And you got to get it done.
It's your eyes and your ears and your brain.
That's right.
The one thing I always teach my students is, a lot of times, especially in the part of Louisiana that I was in, I'd go to high school where this was the best medical care these kids were getting.
Exactly right.
Period.
That's
and,
right.
You know, they didn't have the insurance to go get the MRI, the X-ray.
Right.
So you know what? I am the MRI. I am
right.
the X-ray. And I've got to be able to communicate with a lot of these different people. Okay, so that gets us to you finish 4 years of osteopathic medical school. It's a 5-year residency program. And then you're a hand surgeon. So you've got to go on for a fellowship.
One more year
of hand fellowship.
Right.
And so where do you do that?
I did that at Baylor here in Houston.
Okay. Yeah. And then, you talked about your still hovering around that sports medicine,
mm-hmm.
right? So your background as an athletic trainer and as an osteopath. In your training, residency, fellowship, did you have any sports medicine rotations?
Yep. Everybody has, you've got some dedicated rotations in the different various areas of specialization.
Mm-hmm.
In the orthopedic surgery residency, you have to have, basically a certain, and it's a huge system of check boxes where you've got to be proficient at doing a lot of different things.
Right.
So for them to graduate you and say you're ready to be an orthopedic surgeon, this is something that this is where you're good at a lot of these. You're proficient. You may not be the world's foremost expert at them, but you can get it done.
Right. You're proficient. Right.
Right.
We have these clinical integration proficiencies in athletic training where we're going to go down to check boxes. Is that really what they're doing is that can you meet the entry level qualifications of
right.
a physician?
Right.
So let me ask you a question. You brought up a great subject, and one of the things that I always tell my students is if you don't know your anatomy, you don't know anything.
That's right.
So today we were talking about some lower extremity stuff, and I gave an example. If a patient presents to you with some pain in knee flexion and internal tibial rotation, it's what hamstring muscle are we talking about? And, they floundered around a little bit. It's semitendinosus, and this is why.
Right.
So we talked about that. With your education, you just said that osteopaths are they have a little bit more anatomy education in medical school. Did you feel like you were a little bit more prepared to go into your residency and fellowship because of that anatomy background?
Absolutely. The unique feature of where I trained up in Toledo, there's a neighboring medical school in Toledo. At the time it was called Medical College of Ohio, now it's affiliated with the University of Toledo. But we would, we would often share rotations with those other medical students from MCO at the time. And I, you feel like, well, I'm coming from a smaller program, not as well, well identified labeling that you bring up. And I felt like,
you're running circles around these guys.
We knew the anatomy, we knew how to apply it,
right.
We knew what it meant.
Right.
And that was the key feature. For me, you're building your foundation of your education. It's anatomy, it's physiology, and biochemistry. And then you can build your house any way you want. If that structure, that foundation is not stable,
right.
If it's on sand and fog, good luck.
So one of the things I've always said in athletic training is that your foundation is anatomy, physiology, biomechanics, motor learning.
Right.
Those four things, you can figure anything
out.
I don't really care about the names, but I know that the ACL prevents that tibia from sliding forward on a fixed femur. In order to test that, I need to take that tibia and pull it forward on that fixed femur. And I've identified whether that's torn or not.
Mm-hmm.
So you do your fellowship down here at Baylor College of Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens?
Then I took a job with, I was supposed to go back to Ohio and work with the program that I trained at, but my wife said, you can go, but we're staying.
And so, when you say we, you're married and you've got
three kids.
And how old are your kids?
17, 10, and 7. Boys,
wow.
17, just graduated from high school, and the girls are 10 and 7.
So going back, when you were going through medical school.
He was 3. He started when we started, he was 3 years old.
Yeah, how about that?
That was a big jump because, I left a stable, decent paying job.
Yeah.
I wasn't buying, boats or anything, but we were
right.
comfortable.
Right.
I had a great quality of life in Marion, Ohio. And that was a big jump. It was one of those things. If I look back, and I didn't want to say what if,
uh-huh.
And it's we all have a path that's laid out for us,
mm-hmm.
And we just have to have the courage and the faith to take it.
To go get it.
To go get it.
So it's another commonality that we have. When I finished my master's degree, my son was three. My wife was 7.5 months pregnant with our daughter, and I drive from sunny Southern California to Hammond, America, and I'm there for 10 years, and both my kids watch me graduate with my doctorate. And I remember probably a lot like you, you know, my kids looking at me, and if I think about it long enough, I'll start crying. But my kids look at me, and my dad looks and says, "Wow, my dad's a doctor." Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, that's really cool. Right? And probably the same thing.
Yeah, for you. My son was old enough to remember that. He was probably five when I was getting out. And our daughter was born my internship year, so she was a little too young to remember that. But they, you know, it's trial and tribulation, the residency. It's one of those things I tell people now. I said every year is harder than the year before it. Right. I always thought, well, I'll never be so busy, never be busier when I was a first year medical student.
You had a great
days. Awesome. Yeah, I was about 50 pounds lighter. I had all the time in the world comparatively now. So,
that's right.
Yeah, but we did it together, and that's why I say, you know, we went to medical school.
Right.
And my wife, you know, I was the sole provider. She had to go to work, you know, and had to address family care issues and child care issues. And
boy,
it was a load. It was a rough road for everybody. But residency was tough. But you know, you have to have good faith and a good family foundation and background, and otherwise you won't be able to make it.
Yeah, and I remember I occupied our living room table for 2.5 years while I was writing my dissertation. And we couldn't have anybody over to eat. We couldn't have, because everything.
You knew where everything was.
I knew where everything was. And, you know, I would, at the time I was getting my doctorate, and I'm program director for the athletic training program. But I was also program director and clinical coordinator and teaching full time. And I was still doing outreach for Jeff Schmidt over at North Oaks Hospital. And I'd do all that. And I'd write my dissertation. You know, I'd sleep until maybe 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd write my dissertation from 2 to 4 or 2 to 5, and that's just how we did it, right? So you'd go to medical school, you'd come back, and, you know, maybe some of your other friends, they can go out and have a beer, but you're going home to your wife, and you have a child.
Yeah, it made me a better student,
right?
I thought, because, you know,
you got more on the line.
More on the line, and I wasn't interested in, you know, wheeling girls at the bars and saying, hey, I'm in medical school. Yeah, I could do that. My wife's from Puerto Rico, but if I did that, you'd find little pieces of me. You'd never see me again.
Right. So you come down to Baylor for your fellowship, right? And boy, fellowship, you're kind of like, you're the senior in the high school, right?
Yeah, that's
kind
exactly
of
right.
That's kind of the way it is.
Yeah.
Right. You're a big man on campus.
Yeah.
But you know, you still, and so you're doing your fellowship at Baylor, mm-hmm. and who's directing that fellowship?
So at the time it was Michael Epstein and David Netcher. They were both my mentors, and then they had a host of other surgical staff, hand upper extremity specialists that we would also rotate with.
And then you get picked up by UT Physicians.
Actually, I was at Baylor for 3 years.
Okay.
I joined the faculty there when my wife said, "You can go, but we're staying."
Yeah, that's right.
So divorce is out of the question. It's too expensive anyway. Right?
That's right.
I had a terrific opportunity at Bentall, which is the county hospital here.
Uh-huh.
Heavy trauma. I was doing mostly,
again, you're going to learn a lot, right?
Yeah,
you're thrown into a mash
fire.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So, and I was doing general orthopedic trauma, specializing in the upper extremity stuff, but you know, I'm rebuilding knees and ankles and hips and pelvic stuff and all of that. It's just, you know, all that stuff.
And at a county hospital, you're going to see everything.
Everything. And it's the worst of the worst.
Uninsured and underinsured.
That's right. And these people that come up from Mexico, they had already had something done, or they haven't had anything done, and they've had this fracture for 2 or 3 weeks, and now it's infected, or it's a disaster. And, you know, it sounds terrible, but poor people have the worst problems because they don't address them.
Right.
They're complicated by other problems, diabetes, lack of care, and that bothers me. I'm proud to have said that I stood a post at Bentall. I still have I still go to LBJ, and that's an important part of my practice. I want to give that component back to the community, because I never want to refuse care to somebody because of their inability to pay or whatever their insurance is.
You know, my mentor, Dr. Bornstein, and I took this over from what he taught me on the clinical side to kind of this mantra that I developed in education, that the student is my customer, my product, and my asset. That's right. What we're doing again. But he always said, you know, you treat the patient first.
Right.
Worry about everything. And I think that's more of a DO type mentality. And what's really interesting about everything you're saying is that it really resonates really well with the athletic trainer. And so you're at Baylor. And then how do you get over to UT Physicians?
Grace of God and Walt Lowe reaching down in the ocean and saying, hey, I need, you know, we've got an opportunity here.
He found you.
Yeah, out of the blue. I didn't go looking to him. I was treading along, you know, enjoying my time at Baylor. I wanted something a little more, you know, being at Ben Taub, you're kind of on a deserted island.
Sure.
And I had a little bit of a small private practice that I was doing through Baylor. Wasn't well supported, and I was getting frustrated with that. And I was at a point where I'm just going to dump the private part of it and stick with Ben Taub. And just the way things work out, Walt Lowe approached me and said, I got an opportunity, I'd like to talk to you about it. I told him, yeah, I'm happy here, but then it got me thinking of some things, and I had asked Baylor to make some changes.
Walt does a really good job of making
these things.
He's a good motivator.
Yeah, sure is. it prompted me to ask Baylor to make some changes, and they just flat out said no. And I went back to Dr. Lowe and I said, I'm listening.
Yeah.
And here I am. So I've been here, I was with you 2 years in July.
Another commonality, right? I finished my doctorate, and I loved my time at Southeastern Louisiana University. It was a university where you're doing, you know, you're wearing 10 different hats, and you're learning, right? And you're just in the trenches and the fire, and you're working and you're building. And so once I'm done with my doctorate, I go back to the administration at Southeastern. I said, hey, look, this is everything I've done. I want to try some new things. And, you know, they just weren't in a position to do it. It's not that, hey, we don't like you or whatever. It's just, we just can't do it right now. And that prompted me to go look somewhere else. And just like you said, you know, by the grace of God, Walt Lowe comes down and gets you.
Well, absolutely.
You know, my department chair, Chuck Lane, he reaches down and says, hey, we've got this opportunity for you. And as you and I were talking before, it's a tier one university. I'm the director of the first athletic training program in Houston, and it's a entry-level master's degree in the fourth largest city in the country, and I get to work with, you know, you and all these other places, and I'm happy to say that we signed an affiliation agreement with UT Physicians Department of Orthopedic Surgery. We also did with Memorial Hermann Medical Group, Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Rehab, Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. So through all those collaborations, you know, we're going to be able to work with you, and what I want to do is I want to extend an offer to you to say, you know, I want you to come and I want you to talk to some of the students.
I love that,
And, you know, it sounds like you would really just eat it up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure if I put you in one of those, you know, athletic training classes back again, man, I could
knock
just
out some of the old
that's right.
Combos, but I'd be
that's
right,
right.
Here, man. Yeah.
You know, we'd just put some grease on some of the wheels and we'll get at it.
Yeah.
All right. And so a couple questions I've been asking a few people here. One is, and obviously you have a really unique perspective, right? Some of the physicians that I talk to, I ask, you know, from a physician standpoint, what do you want some of those athletic trainers to know? Now, you're an athletic trainer. You're also a physician. You're also an orthopedic surgeon. So you have this really unique perspective. If you were to, you know, talk to me as an athletic trainer educator, I have a way to kind of change some things. What are some of the things that you want me to know, that you want me to be able to teach these students that are more prepared to get back into that healthcare profession?
Yeah. I think, you know, you kind of already highlighted on some of the key issues. It's, you know, building the foundation as opposed to just learning how to what tool do I need to fix that. You know, getting away from the modalities, getting away from the hands-off components of it, where therapy is, you know, it's a very lucrative, you know, environment to get into, but it's also very passive. You know, you shouldn't be, there's some benefits to TENS units, I understand that, but that's not going to fix the problem.
Right.
So it's not, you know, there's some benefits to ultrasound, but that's not going to fix the problem. So I think from my standpoint is knowing what the modalities do, knowing what, how to use them, but really just getting away from them.
Really, and just using them as an adjunct.
As an adjunct, exactly right. And you know, for me, looking at all the other things as opposed to trying some of these other things. You know, I just gave a talk in there about, you know, some of the hand and wrist injuries. you know, and for the from my standpoint, what do you need to do first? Mm-hmm. Well, let's try those things first instead of like, you've got a wrist problem, I'm going to send you to this guy.
Right.
Like, well, you're an allied health professional.
Right.
You should be able to document accordingly and, you know, initiate a treatment plan.
This right is everything I tried, and once I run into that roadblock, that's now exactly I go right. and refer out.
That's right. Now I'm at my hands are tied, or I'm at that point.
Right.
And then there's some other aspects where, you know, the higher up you get, you know, it's, you know, the NFL, for instance, that stands for not for long.
Yeah, that's yeah. right.
And it's like, listen, I got to get a diagnosis. Is this guy going to be ready for Sunday
right.
or not?
Right.
I'm going to send you right to this guy.
Right.
Now, the nice thing about that is then we can say, okay, this is it, initiate treatment program.
Right.
Okay, non-operative therapy, which is perfect. But, you know, at the periphery, high schools, community levels, you know, they're the foot soldiers, they're the front line. And those are the, from my standpoint, that's what I would want out of the athletic trainer. A good assessment, we've already tried these things.
Right.
You know, this is a chronic overuse injury.
Right.
This ain't working, you know, and then having that element of the musculoskeletal therapy, you know, manipulative medicine treatment components, those are safe. You don't have to take somebody's head to Cleveland and get an right. audible pop.
Right.
A lot of it is just muscle action.
Understanding the biomechanics of how that, you know, I did a demonstration today in class where I manipulated one of my students' necks, and it was just a little bit of distraction, slight, you
it's
know.
Gentle.
Yeah, slight.
You're not trying to kill somebody.
Yeah, lateral rotation. Yeah, that's right. Slight lateral rotation, and, you know, they heard the audible, but he's like, wow, that's amazing.
Right.
Yeah, it's not high thrust, it's not high velocity.
No.
If you understand the biomechanics of how things move, you can almost fix anything.
Exactly right.
What are some other things from an athletic training education side, right? So here I am as an athletic training educator, been on that route as you were too for a while, been doing this for 10 or 12 years, have this really unique opportunity to really change the face of athletic training here with this program. What's something that, you know, as an athletic trainer, as a former athletic trainer educator, now as an orthopedic surgeon, what's something you want me to know?
That's a good question. I think from my standpoint is knowing you as an educator, knowing what I think from my standpoint as a physician that I would feel comfortable in letting those athletic trainers try and mm-hmm. teaching them some things.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's not like, oh, well, you can't do that. Well, you're not a physician. You can teach some of this stuff to anybody.
Right.
And if it's applied in the appropriate setting, in the appropriate hands, you know, not being afraid to think outside of the box of, well, you know, these are the constraints that we have that we're not allowed to teach this.
Right.
And I would, you know, lean more towards being, you know, that type of an educator where, well, let's push the boundaries a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, not being ridiculous and you know, pharmacology is important, but not, you know, not trying to, you know, garner,
right.
you know, prescription writing.
Right.
Because I think we do that too much in this country.
Yeah, I'm not going to put a scalpel in a kid's hand, but
right.
on the other hand, there's
knowing
this,
your limitations,
right.
you know, knowing what can you do safely in the proper setting with, you know, with the proper training.
And now one of the faster growing fields in athletic training is this physician extended role.
Mm-hmm.
And that we see a model at Emory, and I've talked to Dr. Lowe a little bit about he's been approached a few times, and we're going to try to use this Master of Athletic Training program as a platform where, you know, once my students come out of this program and they graduate, now they can go into a physician extended residency program.
Yeah.
And what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's awesome. Actually, a good friend of mine from LSU, Robert Baudier, he's a physician extender as an athletic trainer, I think somewhere down in Georgia.
Probably close to Emory.
Yeah. I don't know where he did his training. May have been at Emory.
Yeah.
And I just love the guy. And I thought, if you ever get tired of that guy, you come over here and I'll snatch you right up.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's those people. They've got that practical sense and that practical background.
Right.
And you've got hands on the job training, which
right.
is invaluable. Even, you know, I just been graced with a physician assistant
right.
that I'm still trying to, you know, mold and shape a little bit.
And those PAs are really trained in more family medicine, general practice.
Just general practice.
Yeah.
Because, and it's a month of this, a month of this,
right.
a month of this.
Whereas
and
the athletic trainer has extensive orthopedic
exactly
knowledge.
Exactly right. And if you take it into consideration, you know, if you've got a baccalaureate degree, that's 4 years of training.
Right.
And then most people are going on for master's
right.
degrees or the additional extensive training
right.
or extended training. And that's, you know, you're coming in there, you've got a boatload of knowledge and hopefully some wisdom with all those years. And it's kind of hard when we're asking a PA to do certain things, and some of it's, you know, some of it's technique driven, some of it is just, you know, well, I don't really have an orthopedic surgery, any orthopedic surgery background at all.
Right.
You know, you read their CVs, they're all very talented, they're very smart, very gifted, but they don't have any orthopedic surgery background. So I'm teaching them how to evaluate a wrist or an elbow or a shoulder. And
right, so if it's a general orthopedic, right, the athletic trainer walks in and does the apprehension test and comes back and tells you
exactly what it
is. Hey, look, here's what it is, here's what we're doing. And you know, you the two of you are able to consult a little bit, say, is this a surgical intervention or not? If it's not a surgical intervention, then you write a script right back to that athletic trainer, say, we're going to do rehab, and it's all in-house.
It feeds itself, right?
Right.
That's exactly right. And it's not something, and at least you know where they're going. You know, it's like you're referring a friend or a family member to somebody that's good.
Right.
You know, and you know you can trust them, and you know they're going to get the job done.
Well, I got to tell you, this has been an absolute great find. You know, you said before, I think that similar to you, I think we have some similar beliefs. When I was driving from Southern California to Louisiana, we wanted to take my son to the aquarium in Houston because we stayed here. And my wife looks it up online, and she finds this great place called the Aquarium at the Kima Boardwalk. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's not an aquarium, it's a restaurant called the Aquarium. But we go down there, and this is the most incredible time that we've ever had. And for the next 10 years, we talk about this experience for, you know, probably a half a dozen times a year over 10 years. So 60, 70 times we talk about it. I get this opportunity in Houston, and the department chair picks me up, takes me out to dinner. Where do you think he takes me? Right to that exact place that we were 10 years ago. And I call my wife, and I say, you'll never believe where I am.
Destiny,
and
yeah.
She says, where? And I said, I can touch the playground. This is where we are. She says, no way. If they offer it to you, you've got to take it. And you're right. This is destiny. So I think the fact that you and I are here together is one of those other examples of destiny. Well, again, thank you very much for everybody listening to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I'm Dr. Josh Yellen with the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program, www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. You can catch us on Twitter, UofHMAT. Catch us on the Sports Medicine Broadcast at PHS Sports Med or hashtag the SMB. And for Dr. Keplinger, thank you very much. This has been outstanding. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, bye.